I got three Isaiah original players.
Seen.
Try to find out what Iron Eye is all about. In the meantime, oh, Bella G, and want some music for I.
Blood, 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 blood and fire. Blood, blood, blood and fire.
Rastafari and reggae music, you know, is one, you know, because reggae music is the expression of the truth and righteousness. So reggae and Rasta is always close together.
Roots music is about making people aware of what's happening around them and making people look back at their ancient customs and culture.
Rastafari.
Mercy, Lord.
Rastafari was not an organized religion in Jamaica. We didn't have any newspaper, we didn't have a church, and we didn't have no media outlet to propagate this consciousness. The music was the outlet for that.
Bob Marley and the Wailers are only the tip of the iceberg. So if you are inspired by the music of Bob Marley, then it's a good opportunity to check out what else is out there, because there's a vast amount and so much of it is neglected.
Blood, blood, blood and fire. Oh, mercy, Lord.
Root rock reggae. Just a reggae music. Root rock reggae. Just a reggae music.
30 years ago, city streets across Britain came alive with the sounds of roots reggae. In Brixton, St Paul's, Handsworth, Toxteth, Chapeltown and Tiger Bay, young black people found a voice in a music and a culture they could call their own. And the wider British public had to get used to a new type of black youth, with dreads, herbs and red, gold and green. This was the world I grew up in, and now reggae and Rastafari are everywhere. Thanks to Bob Marley, the world's most famous Rasta, reggae and Rastafari are now part of our mainstream culture. But this isn't Bob's story. It's bigger than that. This is the story of a movement that had a profound effect on a country's people and music. It's about a faith that gave black people hope and a religion they could call their own. It's also a story about one of the most exciting periods in reggae music. Welcome to Blood and Fire. I'm Don Letts, and tonight I'll take you back, or is that forward, to the golden period of roots reggae. Most people know about the clichés associated with Rasta, the dreadlocks and the ganja smoking. But there's a lot more to this highly spiritual movement that has had such an influence on Jamaica than hairstyles and herb. The roots of Rastafari, as most people know it, can be traced back to the early 1900s, when Jamaican trade unionist Marcus Messiah Garvey left Kingston, Jamaica for New York. There he established the Universal Negro Improvement Association to help readdress the historical injustice of the slave trade and its resulting diaspora. The emphasis was on self-help, a new black civilization, and a return to Africa.
We hear the cry of England for the Englishman, of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Japan for the Japanese, of China for the Chinese. We of the Universal Negro Improvement Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad.
Garvey won widespread support, and by the 1920s, the UNIA had 5 million members. He set up a shipping company, the Black Star Liner, to take black people back to Africa. The company, unfortunately, went bust, but Garvey's teachings of black determination struck a chord with the poor in his home country of Jamaica, who were living under an oppressive British colonial rule. He is considered a prophet by Rastafarians, especially for this proclamation.
Look to Africa, when a black king shall be crowned, for the day of deliverance is near.
Rastafarians believe the crowning of Rastafari as Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia to be the genesis of Rastafari. Ras and Tafari are Amharic words meaning prince and creator, respectively. As Ethiopia was one of the few uncolonized countries in Africa at that time, many black people took his coronation to be the fulfillment of Garvey's prophecy in November of 1930. From the 1930s onwards, the movement began to gain popularity around Jamaica. It seemed to be based in Judaism and Egyptian mysticism, but it was clear that the Rastafarians believed that Emperor Haile Selassie was the return of the Messiah, as told in the Bible. It hit home with some Jamaicans because for the first time, they had their own black religion and a black god. Rastafarian singer Little Roy explains why it connected to the people.
I used to go to Christian church, and through all these teachings, they're still searching because it's like something still not right. Christ is always portrayed as a white picture. So it's like there is nothing for the black. We had to have something for ourselves.
Rastafari helped black Jamaicans learn about their past. Dub poet Muta Baruka.
Rastafari was able to shape identity, and that is really shaping a cultural identity to a people that was lost in colonialism. We were led to believe that the only history that Africa have was slavery. We did not know that there was a history in Africa before slavery.
In 1940, Rastafari's first preacher, Leonard Howell, set up the first Rasta community in the hills of Jamaica's capital, Kingston. They were self-sufficient and peaceful, but were seen as strange by many people. The British colonial authorities took exception to their cultivation of marijuana, and the camps were broken up. The Rastafarian movement began to spread and gain many converts, and by the end of the 1950s, there were around 15,000 Rastas and an equal number of sympathizers in the Kingston ghettos. Most people agree that roots reggae's golden period was the mid to late 70s, but we can trace Rasta influence in the music way before then. Rico Rodriguez, the legendary Jamaican trombonist, was born in 1934, and he remembers hearing Rasta music on the streets as a child.
Rastaman music is an original source. It's like an original African-style music that is embedded in the people. Because if the people were doing the street, if they were making a road and digging the street, they would be using the pickaxes or the shovels, and they would be singing, and it's like a hum. So Jamaica have a musical tone from every source.
Follow man, call your baby dead.
Follow man, call your baby dead.
Follow man, call your baby dead.
Follow man, call your baby.
It's clear that the Rastafarian message can also be heard in the early Jamaican music of Mento. This calypso-style music is often associated with tourism, but is actually rooted in ancient African themes and rhythms. Many of the Mento musicians were Rastas, and although most of them would keep that quiet, you could hear it surface from time to time.
My greatest ambition is to see the face of my fatherland, where my forbearance were hunted many years, and dumped in the West Indies as slaves. Caused me to be a wandering African, like all black American, so I've got to claim my identity with the African family.
That was Lord Invader and his Caribbean Knights with Africa Here I Come. During the 1950s, Rico Rodriguez attended the Alpha Boys School in Kingston. This was a remedial school run by strict nuns, which single-handedly provided Jamaica with most of the top ska musicians of the 1960s. They were schooled in classical music theory, but after school, most of them would head up to the Rasta camps for an altogether different musical education.
In school, you just do scales and classical music. But amongst the Rastas now, you can play freely. So from the first time I learned that I could play free, I could improvise as much as I wanted. And in the eyes of the Rasta, you didn't play in the wrong notes, everything was good. So that was my development coming from the Rasta.
With Jamaica's prominent and up-and-coming musicians hanging around at the Rasta camps, cultural themes began to surface in the music. You can hear them in early 1950s songs, like Laurel Aitken's Zion.
I'll be going back to Zion on that day,
on that day.
I'll be going back to Zion on that day,
on that day.
Or even Clancy Eccles' Freedom.
Before I be a slave, I'll skip over my grave and go home to my father.
The musicians at the camps were also learning the Naya Bingi drumming of Rastafari that would later be a big part of the root sound. musicologist Garth White.
In the early days, Rasta didn't have a music of its own, right? And early members of the faith gravitated to neo-African styles that were still in evidence in Jamaica.
Here's Rico Rodriguez.
Rasta drum playing is an art, you know. It's not really easy. You may feel like you can play it, but when you start playing it, you're playing it out of time. Classical music had a method, but the Rastaman music have no method. Because if you follow a method, you cannot do anything but that method. So that I learned that from the Rastaman.
Rico was taught by a prominent Rasta leader and drummer, the famous Count Ozzy, who lived in the Warwicka Hills of Kingston. In 1960, he was recorded for the first time by producer Prince Buster. Reggae writer David Katz.
The landmark recording that everyone points to as the first example of Rastafari music in popular recorded music of Jamaica is the Folks Brothers' O Carolina, which featured Count Ozzy and his Rasta drumming troupe. It's actually a very peculiar recording. It was very revolutionary for its time. And it made such a strong impact on the public in Jamaica when it was aired on sound systems that apparently the public demanded that it be played on Jamaica's two radio stations, both of which initially refused to play it.
Rastafari.
The Rastafarian influence was becoming more apparent as the ska era dawned in the early 1960s. Dub poet Muta Baruka.
In the 60s, it was mostly instrumental music. So even though there was a lot of Rasta-minded people who was making music, but they weren't singing, they were blowing. Most of them were horns men. And what happened, they used to name the songs, like Addis Ababa and Ethiopia and Africa, but they weren't actually singing the message.
And this is Addis Ababa by the Skatalites, named after the Ethiopian capital city. People kept their Rasta allegiances quiet as the Rasta man was scorned by society. Here's Muta Baruka.
There was a time when Rasta couldn't walk on the streets in Jamaica. When it just started in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you hardly see the Rasta on the streets. When you do see a Rasta, people think that it was a madman.
Carl Bradshaw, the Rastafarian film star of The Harder They Come.
Rasta men would get so many beatings from police. They would cut the locks. And in cutting the locks, they'd probably use a dull knife. They'd be incarcerated for days without or charge. And if you're caught with a spliff, it's automatic.
Virus database has been updated.
Historical events would help Rastafari become more accepted by Jamaican society. The first was independence from the colonial rule of Britain in 1962. The Abyssinians, Bernard Collins.
The whole island was looking for a direction, a cultural direction, somewhere to go and something to hang on to. And Rastafari was the only thing.
Gather together, be brothers and sisters, we're independent.
Reggae historian Garth White.
With independence had come the flowering of our indigenous musical practices and greater confidence. People felt more able to voice what they felt inside.
There was also the Jamaican visit of the Rastafarians' living god, Haile Selassie, in April 1966. Over 100,000 Rastas attended the event. The Wailers' Peter Tosh was one of the many young Jamaicans in the crowd, and this song, Rasta Shook Them Up, was recorded about the event days later. The Wailers' biographer, John Missouri.
The visit of Emperor Haile Selassie to Jamaica was a highly effective milestone in the history of Jamaican music. There were record numbers of people at the airport to greet him. Every Rasta on the island flocked to catch a glimpse of him.
As Rasta musicians and singers grew in confidence, so did the number of songs being recorded. In 1969, the Jamaican charts were set alight by the first openly Rastafari hit record, Bongo Naya, by the singer Little Roy. Here's Little Roy.
It really changed a lot of things when it comes to the music in Jamaica, that song, you know, because it was the first Rasta song, the first song in that context to really be number one, you know, on the radio station, you know, a song talking about Jah and fire and all those kind of things, you know.
Little Roy explains how the song came about.
First, it's a nursery rhyme. It's a fusion from Baba Black Sheep Have You Any Wool. Rastaman always called the ear wool. So I changed the song to Baba Baba Have You Any Wool. Yes, Jah, yes, Jah. One big head full.
Singing Rastafari lyrics met with resistance from the all-powerful record producers. Lloyd the Matador, the producer of Bongo Naya, made Little Roy tone down the lyrics because he thought they were a little too Rasta. The big-name producers, like Duke Reid, refused to record Rasta songs at all. Musicologist Garth White.
Duke clearly was anti-Rasta because he was a former policeman, and so he was cut of the same cloth as the colonial authorities, who saw Rasta as barbarian and just a little bit short of raving madmen.
Rastafarian songwriters began to take matters into their own hands. A young Bernard Collins saved up enough money for studio time to record a song on his own terms. It would become the Rastafarian anthem with his group, the Abyssinians.
There is a land far, far away, where there's no night, there's only day. Look into the book of life.
The Abyssinians were formed in 1969 when Bernard Collins and Donald Manning met in Jonestown, Kingston. They were the first group to sing in the Ethiopian language of Amharic and rehearsed in their local church. Bernard Collins.
Donald, older brother, used to get literatures from Ethiopia, books, Ethiopian opinions, and we could go through these books and see the Amharics and the interpretation in English. We could know that Sata Amasagana La Amlak Ulagize means give thanks to God continually. So we just combine those words together in our melodies and bring them out in a song.
Reggae historian Garth White.
Abyssinians have at least two classic tunes that are numbered amongst the best in the roots rock reggae tradition, namely Sata Amasagana, which is known the world over as the Rasta anthem, and Declaration of Rights, which is your archetypal protest song.
Get up and fight for your rights, my brother. Get up and fight for your rights, my sister.
Another vocal trio that formed around the same period was the Mighty Diamonds, the group with beautiful harmonies but with their hearts rooted in dread.
Jah bless the dreadlocks in a Babylon. Jah bless the dreadlocks who understand.
The Diamonds all lived in the notorious Trenchtown area of Kingston, and this was to have an effect on their music. Bunny Diamond explains.
Trenchtown was more like a kind of ghetto. It's really rough, you know. More like some shantytown type of living. That people in a trench coat, I go to school and I wear shoes. So we sing and write about things that we see happen day by day.
There is a place in Africa. They call the
Abyssinians and the Mighty Diamonds paved the way for many great vocal harmony groups in the Roots mold, such as the former ska band, the aptly named the Ethiopians.
Here, Rasta Branda, here. I see you get out of jail. No bars couldn't keep you.
And their friends, the Gladiators. I'm Don Letts, and you're listening to Blood and Fire on BBC Radio 2. As more and more Rastafarian singers and groups came to the fore, we can now say that the late 60s was the birth of roots music. Up until this point, even Bob Marley and the Wailers weren't Rasta. Although they had been recording since the early 1960s, they didn't have dreadlocks yet and weren't openly singing about Rastafari. They had more of a soul image. But 1969 did see the beginning of the career of one of roots reggae's greatest stars and one of Rastafari's biggest exponents, Burning Spear.
Marcus, can words come to pass? Marcus, can words come to pass? No food to eat, can't get no money to spend.
Reggae journalist David Katz.
More than anyone else, Spear is the one that brings in roots reggae and makes it a viable genre and begins to shift the focus increasingly towards Rastafari and towards music that deals with the struggle of ordinary black Jamaicans.
Burning Spear initially started out as the Burning Spears, led by lead singer Winston Rodney. Winston had taken the advice of Bob Marley and moved from the country to Kingston to audition for producer Clement Dodd. He told Winston that his backup singer was not up to scratch, so Winston went alone as the Burning Spear. And one of the first songs he recorded was the phenomenal Door Peep.
Who shall not enter this whole land? The wax is on a tree, man standing, sipping from the cup of peace.
You hear Door Peep, it's a very individual recording. Very evocative recording with a lot of different things happening in the brass section, something about this very prominent, very deep bass, and then to cap it all, Spear's booming, thunderous voice with these really ominous, religiously inspired lyrics.
Burning Spear spent the 70s releasing an astonishing body of work, committed to Rastafari and Marcus Garvey. To many black people, his music was a much-needed breath of fresh air. David Hines of Steel Pulse.
The main characters when you go into typical Jamaican home, there's always a picture of Jesus, picture of the Prime Minister, whoever they are, and the Queen of England, and John F. Kennedy. So you sort of grow up with this consciousness of everything that's to rule you or to make you better in this world, you know, to be white. So as soon as we heard Burning Spear with the Marcus Garvey philosophy, we thought we needed to be part of that experience.
Burning Spear had a huge impact in Jamaica and became internationally successful from the late 1970s onwards, only stopping short of megastardom due to his uncompromising sound and commitment to the Rastafari faith. He still records and tours today, winning a Grammy in 1999. Despite these early roots artists selling records, Rasta was still being shunned by the Jamaican recording industry. It was left to Jamaica's outdoor mobile discos, or sound systems, to act as a catalyst for ushering in this new era of roots rock reggae. The selector, or DJ, would chat between each record, announcing details of future dances or song information. But as Rastafari and roots records became more popular, DJs began to shout out Rasta slogans over the records themselves, and soon became stars too. Witness Big Youth.
I prayed it, vast kings of the earth that set themselves on the ruling state council together. Against the Lord God, the Rastafari, and against his anointed saying, now come let us break their bands of sunder, and cast away the cards from us.
By 1974, Big Youth was a huge star in Jamaica, and with the slower, heavier drum and bass music of Roots providing a more suitable platform for DJs chattering, new DJs like Iroy, Tapazuki, Just Ditch, Dillinger, and Prince Farai sprang up, helping Roots Reggae on its way to becoming the number one sound.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
1973 saw the release of the Wailers' second LP, Burning.
Stand up for your right.
By this time, the Wailers were including conscious lyrics in their music and had signed to Chris Blackwell's Island Records, which would become the home for many Roots artists in the 1970s. The Bob Marley story is well documented, and without a doubt, he's the most successful and popular Roots artist of all time. But often overlooked are his bandmates, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer, both of whom left the Wailers that year. Both ex-Wailers would record important Roots reggae records that spread the message of Rastafari on an international level. Roots singer Pam Hall.
Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailers. When that group broke up, to me, it simply tripled the music because these were three very strong characters, very talented characters. So when they broke up, each person got more space to express themselves, and each person has really left a legacy of great music.
Bunny Wailer seemed the most spiritual and outwardly Rastafarian of the Wailers and released a critically acclaimed album proving just that. Wailers biographer John Missouri.
Bunny Wailer's first album after leaving the Wailers was Black Heart Man. He recorded that with members of the Wailers band, and it was a classic with songs like Armageddon and Black Heart Man.
Growing in a neighborhood for such a long time that is filled with fear. I can't go here, can't go there, and I ain't supposed to go anywhere, anywhere at all. She got me black heart man, children. I said don't go near him. She got me black heart man, children. Or even lions fear him.
David Katz.
It's one of the first international albums to strongly proclaim a Rastafari identity and to speak uncompromisingly of the position of black people in the West and the struggle affecting poor people worldwide. It's a very influential album, very much a landmark album.
Peter Tosh would have even more of an impact on Roots music. Known as the Stepping Razor, he was the most outspoken of the 1970s Roots artist and a committed political activist.
Arise, black man, arise and know thyself.
Peter's first album after leaving the Wailers was Legalize It.
Legalize it. Don't criticize.
It's a very powerful album, taking a very uncompromising stance, not only about calling for the legalization of marijuana, but also, again, just speaking about injustice facing black people in the West.
Next door neighbor, them hold your son, said them find him with one gun, and it's no need him start to mention, him going to get an detention.
Wailers biographer, John Missouri.
He tirelessly campaigned for equal rights and justice. Other artists expressed their beliefs in Rastafari in a more idealistic way. Peter was more antagonistic, he was more aggressive, he was more committed and more fiery.
And the aggression often got him into trouble.
Tosh was someone who had been arrested in Jamaica for protesting against white rule in Rhodesia and spent time in prison, was eventually nearly beaten to death by police in Jamaica because at the One Love Peace concert in 1978, he stood up and harangued the Jamaican Prime Minister and the leader of the Jamaican opposition for 30-40 minutes.
I can't find no sympathy.
Although never as successful as Bob Marley, Tosh did become an international star, later signing to the Rolling Stones label and also EMI. Tragically, he was murdered in mysterious circumstances in his own home by gunmen on September 11th, 1987. and reggae lost a truly righteous voice on that day.
Smoke them like a pipe and.
As the 70s progressed, the lyrics in roots reggae developed alongside the music. Many of the themes had been about Rastafari, but artists also began to sing about the suffering and hardships of life in Jamaica, brought about by the political climate of the time. Jamaican poet Muta Baruka.
In the 70s, you see the music start to shape itself into an ideology and a philosophy of liberation and freedom for black people. Because Rastafari was not organized religion in Jamaica. We didn't have any newspaper, we didn't have a church, and we didn't have no media outlet to propagate this consciousness. The music was the outlet for that.
By the summer of 1971, politics and Rastafarian music became very involved. Since independence in 1962, the Jamaican Labour Party had been in power, but they appear to have little regard for the poorer classes. Jamaicans wanted a change, and Michael Manley's opposition party were taking no chances letting the opportunity of a victory slip. They could see how popular Rastafari and roots music was with the poorer people, and literally hitched a ride. Manley actually formed a PNP musical bandwagon, a touring truck with a makeshift stage for performing reggae artists. Reggae musicians also became associated with the PNP, such as Max Romeo, whose song Let the Power Fall was used for the Manley election campaign.
Oh, let the power fall on high, for I, let the power fall on high. Oh, let the power from Zion fall on high, let the power fall on high.
Manley easily won the election, but it soon became apparent that the policies he'd promised weren't being put into place. Max Romeo felt compelled to write a response.
It was a matter of making him aware of the fact that people in the street are grumbling because the things that he promised to the people wasn't forthcoming. And even myself was being heckled in the street by people who say, hey, you know, you're the part of putting this government into place and nothing is happening, you know, what's up? So I just wrote the song.
The song was called No Joshua No, directly aimed at the Prime Minister, and addressed him by his nickname.
No, in the desert I am buttered and bruised. They think they are forsaken, they think they have been used. Since you are my friend, Joshua, I think you should know, Joshua. Rasta is watching and blaming.
Such was the power of roots reggae at that time that the message got straight through to Manley.
I was invited to meet with him when I went. He said that the song was very inspiring and he has it three times on one cassette in his car. Plays night and day. And he's asking me to cool down and sing in these political songs because he knows that Jamaica people is listening. And it was after that that all the social programs come into place.
Max Romeo's following album, War in a Babylon, is a blistering attack on the government's corruption.
War in a Babylon, tribal war in a Babylon.
It's an album packed with political songs, and it paved the way for many root songs with a protest message, such as John Holt's Up Park Camp. Junior Mervyn's Police and Thieves.
Police and thieves in the street.
And Burning Spears, Throw Down Your Arms. The influence of roots music on Jamaican politics in the 1970s cannot be underestimated. And even Bob Marley got caught up in the crossfire. He was nearly killed by a politically motivated shooting in 1976. But this incident did inspire him to create one of popular music's most historical events. Just days after the shooting, he performed Injured to Thousands in Kingston's National Heroes Park and invited the warring leaders on stage. He then made them shake hands as a gesture to quell the political violence. It has to be one of the most memorable times that music has ever influenced politics.
Rastafari.
In August 1975, Rastafari's living deity, Haile Selassie, reportedly died after a communist coup in Ethiopia. Some sections of Jamaican society mock the Rastas. How can your God die? But this didn't seem to shake their beliefs. Rastas either didn't believe that he died or took the stance that God is ever living. Some big-name Rastas like Bob Marley and Burning Spear came out with songs as a testament to this, like Spear's Jah Not Dead.
Try to fool the black population, telling them that Jah Not Dead. And they try to fool the black population, like telling them that Jah Not Dead.
Roots reggae moved into the mainstream. And by the mid-70s, the old guard of record producers had relinquished their no Rasta stance and were producing conscious records. A new breed of producers came to prominence too, who would help develop the root sound further still. Two of the most influential were Joe Gibbs and Bunny Stryker Lee. While Joe Gibbs had pretty much every major Roots artist running through his studio, it's Bunny Lee who is credited with creating some of Roots' most distinctive rhythms with his studio band, The Aggravators. Reggae writer David Katz.
The Aggravators were setting up to do a recording session for Stryker, Bunny Stryker Lee. So they're doing a little warm-up session in the recording studio, and Santa, the drummer, is trying to imitate what's known as the Philly bump beat, which revolves around an open and closed hi-hat. So it's like...
Oh, yeah.
So Stryker comes in while they're doing this thing, and he goes, yes, that's the sound we want. We'll run the track. And he has them lay down some rhythms doing this style. And among the first was this song called None Shall Escape the Judgment with an upcoming singer called Johnny Clark.
None shall escape the judgment in this time. These words I sing to all mankind. None shall escape the judgment in this time. These words I sing to all mankind.
Johnny Clark.
None shall escape the judgment is about I and I as human being. There's a way of life, and learn to the fact that there will be a day when every man has to face the judgment. So no man shall escape the judgment, because every man has to face the judgment. And so it's all about telling them that plain and straight.
The song was a huge hit for Johnny Clark, who went on to be one of the biggest root singers of the 1970s. Many of Bunny Lee's other singers used the flying cymbal sound too, like John Holt, Delroy Wilson, Linville Thompson, and Horace Andy, to great success. Other rhythm styles also followed, such as the popular Rocker's Rhythm, developed by drummer Sly Dunbar. Heard here on Leroy Smart's Ballistic Affair.
Show away your gun, show away your knife, let us all unite. Everyone is living in fear, just through this ballistic affair.
One producer out there on his own, as always, was Lee Scratch Perry. He set up the Black Ark studio in his garden so he could experiment with new studio techniques without having to worry about the costs. Lee Perry's biographer, David Katz.
It was called the Black Ark because Scratch's mission with this studio was partly to make somewhere that black Jamaicans could come, and particularly Rastafarians, and find sanctuary where they could record music that was in praise of the Almighty and that was expressing a Rastafari worldview.
And from late 1973, the Black Ark became central to Roots reggae, not just because of the artists that recorded there, but also because of Scratch's ability to make songs sound fresh and new. Many great records were made there, most notably from the likes of Max Romeo, Junior Mervin, The Heptones, and of course, Perry's own band, The Upsetters. Max Romeo recalls what it was like to record there.
The Black Ark studio was a little box full of creativity. If you come to that studio and realize that this sound is coming out of a little box, it's amazing. Scratch also is amazing because he gets music and sound out of anything, out of a stone, out of an old tin can, a piece of metal. He creates sounds from these things. Okay, you finish recording a song for Scratch and you go home. You come back the next day, transform into something totally different. Because I said he stays up all night with all these little fandangles and change the whole thing. It's just a little miniature studio. It freaks you out when you get there.
Lucifer, son of the morning,
I'm gonna chase you out of earth.
By the mid-1970s, Rastafari's influence on Jamaican music was everywhere. Since Bob Marley signed to Island and was becoming internationally famous, Island and their market rivals Virgin were looking for the next dreadlock rebel to make a star. Rasta singer Little Roy.
It seemed like it's when Rasta come in, people care more about the money. This create from the time of Bob Marley, you know, because it's like a lot of people never know that Rasta could make so much money. You understand? You
know? Bob Marley biographer John Missouri.
I think after 1975, artists that didn't have dreadlocks and who weren't singing about Rastafari were definitely at a disadvantage. I think because of those conditions, a lot of artists probably did adopt the trappings of Rastafarians without really believing in their hearts what they were singing about.
This is a message from Jah.
Some of the genuine Rasta musicians began to feel some artists were jumping on the Rasta bandwagon just to get signed. Max Romeo even had a song for it, Rasta Bandwagon.
See one day, say my shiny Rasta. This a one say, him a clean face crew. That they one say, him we see you in the Iowa. Everyone claims them a Rasta now.
Greetings in that divine and precious name of our Lord Emperor Haile Selassie I first.
Meanwhile, over in the UK, many young black people began to identify with Jamaican roots music. Britain already had the string-laden pop reggae from labels like Trojan, but by the early 70s, that sound had begun to wear thin. This new roots music struck a chord with young British blacks as it dealt with themes which they could easily identify. Broadcaster Ranking Miss P was a young black girl living in London in the mid-70s.
I couldn't see where else I could fit in. I was born in England, but I'm not English. I'm not treated as someone from England. When you look at me, you see a black woman, and the only thing I could identify with at that time was the roots and culture messages that were coming from the artists from Jamaica.
Dennis Bevel was originally from Barbados, but grew up in London.
Around about the 70s, when suddenly our generation were asking questions about our heritage and wondering why we hadn't been taught any African history, and trying to seek it out, then turn to the history pages of reggae, because there it was documented.
For all us disaffected black British youth who were growing up surrounded by white culture and experiencing racism, roots music and Rastafari showed we had a culture of our own, something we could relate to. The Rastafarian faith became a popular lifestyle choice for many, including myself. I can remember many of my friends trying to come to terms with the Rasta way of life. The scriptures, the vegetarian diet, well, maybe not so much the ganja smoking. And just as Rastas in Jamaica struggled to be accepted by general society, the same thing happened in Britain. With dreadlocks flying, we seem to stand out even more to the authorities. Journalist John Missouri.
The police had a lot of problems with young black youths who adopted that look. Not only because of the ganja smoking and the anger towards the authorities and the resistance towards the system, but also because whenever they gathered in large numbers at concerts or, say, like Notting Hill Carnival, they sensed that there was a threat. There were a lot of civil disturbances at that time created by overzealous policing, I think.
There was a bubbling undercurrent of feeling with the black youth, and UK roots bands sprung up to voice it.
Walking along, just kicking stones, my mind in my own business. I come face to face with my foe, disguised in violence from head to toe. All and I fall, them not let me go.
Birmingham roots band there, Steel Pulse, with Ku Klux Klan. Singer David Hines.
There was no voice for the community as far as the music. We were listening and learning about our African heritage through, you know, the reggae music. And we decided to say, hang on, let's try and air our views through the music, you know, from a British standpoint.
Dennis Bavell from UK roots reggae pioneers Mutumbi.
We wanted to write about the fact that Enoch Powell had said some derogative things about black people. We wanted to ask the question why our African history had been not taught to us. We wanted to put subjects like that to song.
Mutumbi were formed in London in the early 1970s by guitarist Dennis Bavell. And they made their name with tracks like the 1976 hit After Tonight.
Baby After Tonight. Baby After Tonight. Baby After Tonight.
Steel Pulse followed, formed in 1974. And with their Handsworth Revolution album, they put Birmingham on the reggae map, voicing the day-to-day struggle of the young black person in the UK. A word from Miss P.
We love Steel Pulse because their lyrical content was relevant to us and the experiences that we were going through in England at the time with the police and lack of opportunities and just not being able to be free with ourselves.
Lead singer David Hines.
We were trying to get over how we were feeling, high unemployment, police harassment, and, you know, it became prophetical at the time because we wrote that album. And 3 years later, there was riots all over the place. There were revolutions literally happening.
I say equality.
After the success of Mutumbi and Steel Pulse, other UK roots bands formed, such as Mystian Roots, Black Slate, Capital Letters, and of course, Aswad. Heard here with Can't Walk the Streets, a typical example of their late 1970s political music.
I said we can't even walk the streets freely these days. No, we can't. No, we can't be safe.
Initially, many of these bands had difficulty getting gigs because of their Rastafarian beliefs and appearance, and promoters simply couldn't deal. But they found empathy with the punks, who, with their own outrageous fashion and anti-establishment stance, were also meeting resistance from the authorities. David Hines again.
The punks at the time, their philosophy was anything that the system was about, we're not going to be about that. And one of the things the system never really gave a time of day was reggae music or anything that was black orientated. So the punks says, all right, you don't like reggae music? I tell you what, we're gonna have reggae music performing alongside with us, and that's how we got the exposure.
Dennis Bavell.
There was the Rock Against Racism movement that had attempted to merge the likes of punk performers with young British reggae performers and occasionally the actual Jamaican reggae performer, and to promote peace and harmony. And so by that time, quite a lot of white kids were being exposed to the roots side of reggae as opposed to the pop side of reggae and getting into it.
I was actually in the front line of this unlikely cultural alliance as the DJ at the first punk club, the Roxy, playing reggae because there weren't any punk records to play yet. The punks immediately took to the musical reportage style of the lyrics, the bass, and of course the spliffs. Roots reggae had really taken off in the UK by the late 70s, and not just with Jamaican music. It had a scene all of its own.
I, the son of the Most High, Jah Rastafari.
Back in Jamaica, by the late 1970s, early 80s, reggae was dominated by Rastafarian and cultural music. Practically everybody had dreads and were toasting or singing about Rasta. In amongst the mediocre was a lot of great music too. It really was the golden period of roots reggae. In fact, there's so much that it's impossible to include it all in this program. If you like what you've heard, then I recommend you investigate further. However, there are some standout artists from this period that became popular in both Jamaica and the UK and warrant mentioning. Groups like Culture.
When you're gonna dig, happy to tell my brother, don't dig what always dig too. When you're gonna dig, happy to tell my brother, hey, don't dig what always.
And then there was also the uncompromising Black Uhuru, led by Michael Rose and backed by drum and bass legends Sly and Robbie.
I say you're born right here and you're born so that it's going to be crazy. I say you're born right here.
Finally, there were the cultural singers who were merging Rasta themes with mainstream vocalizing. Singers like Horace Andy.
It must be Jah. Yes, it must be Jah. Psalm 68, show I bear.
Gregory Isaacs.
Black a kill black, whoa. But he got a bounce right back, yeah.
And Dennis Brown.
Money in my pocket, but I just can't get no love.
Roots reggae seemed unstoppable. By 1980, roots reggae was firmly established in Jamaica and Europe, and was even getting recognition in the US. Bob Marley was a global superstar, and in the wake of his success, many Jamaican artists such as Burning Spear, Max Romeo, and Lee Perry were re-released. But why were none of these artists as successful as Bob Marley? I think there are many reasons to speculate why Bob was roots reggae's biggest star. Promotion obviously played a part, as did chart-friendly tunes, coupled with undeniable charisma. But I think one of the main reasons is that Bob was able to balance a roots rock rebel sound with that of a more melodic international appeal, something that other Jamaican artists did not find so easy to do. It's interesting that towards the end of Bob's career, he was selling huge amounts worldwide, but not so much in Jamaica. But on the 11th of May 1981, Bob Marley died from cancer. Roots reggae's figurehead had gone, and it seemed to signal the beginning of the end of Rastafarian music. The Abyssinians, Bernard Collins.
When Marley died, he had a lot of guys who used to wear locks started to trimming. To me, people were more seeing Bob Marley, some people, instead of Rastafari or Selassie. You know, and when you fall, a lot of people also fall.
With Bob's passing, roots reggae had lost its only true international figure, and no one stepped in to fill the gap. But in truth, Bob's death wasn't the only reason for roots reggae's decline. Marley's biographer, John Missouri.
It was very likely that Bob Marley's music would have begun to sound outdated. He was already losing touch with the Jamaican audiences, as were many of his contemporaries.
Matumbi's Dennis Bavell.
Roots lyrics began to decline because it began to repeat. There's so many times you can say peace and love, man, you know, and be kind to your brother and, you know, don't do wrong and, you know, be a good boy now.
The reggae audience had been sold this dream of repatriation, of Ethiopia, of love, peace and unity, and yet at the same time it had seen its leading artists die, turn into coke addicts, not live up to what they preached, to lead wealthy lifestyles at the expense of the poor, that the Rastas in Jamaica hadn't been able to effect wide-ranging social reforms. It was business as usual in the ghettos.
Roots reggae's game was up. Its musical ally, punk, had imploded. Politics and violence in Jamaica was way out of hand, and even Lee Perry had burned down his Black Ark studio. Some of the major players, producers and performers moved off the island. People wanted a change, and it came in the form of dancehall. Suddenly, lyrics were about guns, drugs and sex.
Me I go tell you about the days of old, when fishy were not invented. I just push my cock between two rocks, I'm going home quite contented.
Singing about Rastafari soon became passé, and record labels and producers were quick to drop dread singers and pick up dancehall ones instead. Even the real instruments that were so central to roots reggae sound began to disappear. Cultural singer Luciano.
Instead of going in the studio with their live bands and live instruments, people resorted to fabricated sounds that they could get from the computer. One, it's cheaper, and two, easier accessible.
That's not to say that the Rastafarian message died in Jamaican music. In the early 1990s, singers like Garnet Silk and Luciano started the Rasta Renaissance, singing spiritual messages and providing the antithesis to the slackness of dancehall. They became stars in Jamaica. Here's Luciano.
The dancehall thing is like a fad. Comes and it goes. So we find out that the roots is like the water that runs beneath the earth. And from time to time, it comes up in the form of a spring.
Currently, Rastafari's main stars are singers like Capleton, Sizzler and Anthony B. They have given Rastafari a modern Jamaican sound, but still remain true to the roots of culture music, as can be heard here with Capleton's Raggy Road, which uses the Abyssinians' anthem, Sata Masagana, as the rhythm.
It's a raggy road, the road is so rough, a raggy road, the road is so tough.
But most of the new artists haven't gone on to enjoy international success like their 1970s predecessors. Strangely, but perhaps not surprisingly, that's been left to Bob Marley's sons. Although dancehall is still the most popular music coming out of Jamaica today, both Damien and Stephen Marley have enjoyed hit records, continuing the spirit of Rastafari and roots music. Damien with 2005's Welcome to Jamrock and Stephen with 2007's Mind Control album.
Mind control really a deal with mental slavery. Where we say is, if our minds are not free, then there is no way we are free. If the system control our mind, then them control we. Our father, they don't show we are ready, that we have to emancipate ourselves from this mental slavery. And then again, him said, there are no chains around our feet, but we are not free. What does that mean? That means mentally, them enslave I and I, mentally, as a people. It doesn't have anything to do with race, our class, our creed, it's as a people.
Whether we'll ever see Rastafari and roots reggae come to such international attention as it did in the 1970s remains to be seen. But one thing I do know is that Rastafari and roots music is part of Jamaica. And as long as there is a Jamaica, there will always be Rastafari and roots reggae. I'm Don Letts, and this has been Blood and Fire, produced by James Hale. We'll leave you with this from Stephen Marley, Mind Control.
Don't let them mold your mind. They wanna control mankind. Seems like their only intention is to exploit the earth, hey. And you trust in their deceit. Your mind causes your defeat. And so you become an invention to distort the search. Propaganda and lies is a plague in our lives. How much more victimized before we realize, hey, it's mind control.
This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital, and on 88.91 FM.